So we're in the book of Exodus. We've just spent over the past 4 weeks a mini-series really in Genesis, but part of a larger series called From the Beginning, where we're looking at the first five books of the Bible called the Torah or called the Pentateuch. And we're studying this because it's important not just to understand our history, but to understand our faith. One of the things we've been learning and we've been establishing as we've been working our way through the Bible has been that God's plan of redemption to interact with you and with me, to build a people together, to form a church, what he's doing in us even this morning has been a plan of God's even since before the foundation of the world. So we're celebrating that this morning, but we're looking at some of the very first actions that God took as he began to put that plan into place. So in Genesis, we saw that was creation, and we saw that was forming man and woman, and even orchestrating and sovereignly ruling over the fall. Sin enters the world, and God hands down a curse and a punishment for that sin. Adam and Eve are expelled from the garden, and they're told to subdue the earth, but now because of sin, they're having a hard time with that. But they continue to thrive through God's common grace and mercy. They grow and they have descendants and descendants. And eventually we get to a guy named Abraham. And Abraham is visited by God, and God makes a promise to Abraham, then called Abram. Makes a promise the Bible calls a covenant. And this covenant is a binding oath that God makes with Abram to bless him and to make his name great and to make him a father of many nations. It's a promise that was an echo of the first promise given to Adam and Eve in the garden of Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. That one day a seed would come from the woman who would crush the head of the serpent, the one who deceived both Adam and Eve. So Abram is visited by God, and God establishes a covenant that says, what I promise to Adam, your forefather, I promise again to you, and I make this covenant that what I say will come true, that you will inherit a land. I will make you a father of nations. I will make a people for myself from you, Abram, and you will bless the world through that, through your descendants. And of course, Abram doubts a little bit, is shaky in his faith, and God, in Genesis 17, confirms his covenant by establishing this promise with him, and then he brings him through many trials. But Abraham eventually has many sons, a son named Isaac, the promised one. And then Isaac has Jacob, and Jacob has 12 sons, will become the 12 tribes of Israel. And those 12 tribes would grow and grow and grow and become the people of Israel. We read about it in the Old Testament. But if you remember, the end of Genesis ends on the story of Joseph. And if you remember Joseph's story, Joseph was favored by Jacob, his father, but not so much liked by his brothers. And so his brothers decided to sell Joseph, get rid of him. At first decided to kill him, and then somebody, Reuben, had a little bit of common sense about him, said maybe we shouldn't kill him, let's just sell him into slavery. So they sold Joseph into slavery, and Joseph's life gets worse and worse. He goes and he's a slave in Potiphar's house, and he gets in some trouble there, not because he sinned, but because he was accused of sinning, and he gets thrown into jail, and he's in jail waiting. What is God doing with my life? And Joseph has a gift of interpreting dreams, and Pharaoh has a dream that needs interpreting, and Joseph is a man to do it. And so Joseph interprets a dream, and he actually now begins to gain influence and notoriety in the Egyptian kingdom. Even so that he becomes what is essentially the prime minister of Egypt. He's the second-hand man to Pharaoh himself, one of the most powerful people in all the world. And Joseph is at his right hand. And then there's a famine that comes. Part of the dream that he interpreted for Pharaoh, a famine would come, and Joseph helped Egypt avoid that famine. And because of that, Egypt was now able to make money by allowing people to come and borrow from their storehouse. And that includes Joseph's own family. And so we see Joseph come to grips again with his brothers as they come to Egypt to get food and grain lest they starve. And they're reconciled there. And then the story of Genesis ends in chapter 50 with Joseph's family in Genesis or in Egypt. And Joseph dies, so we end in a coffin, and yet the people of God, about 70 in number, are there in Egypt. And that's where Genesis ends, and then we pick up in Exodus. And Exodus is very much a chapter 2 of a sort of five-part chapter or book of the Pentateuch. And you can't read this in the English, but in the Hebrew, the very first word of the book of Exodus is and, as if it picks up on the very next line that Genesis ends on. They share the same author, Moses. And Moses knows, as he's reading and he's writing for his people to hear their history and see and know the promises of God and the faithfulness of God to bring them into the promised land, that Genesis is just as important to the story of Exodus as Exodus is to the story of God's people in their future. So the very first word in the Hebrew of Exodus is "and." And this shows for us that God's plan is continuing to unfold. That he hasn't just ended there with 70 people in Egypt. That he hasn't ended there with a coffin and Joseph buried in the ground. No, he is continuing his story. Of course, we know the story of Exodus if we spend any time around the Bible, or maybe we've grown up around a certain cartoon called The Prince of Egypt, which is sort of accurate, or maybe we've even seen some of the other stories made about it, the movies. It's a very popular, some of the favorite stories of the Bible come from the book of Exodus. But the biggest event in Exodus is the promise that God made to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. That his people will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs for 400 years. And we see God's faithfulness, not only the fulfillment of that promise, but the delivering them out of that land. An exodus is a departing. It's when people leave a place. I'm reminded as I was studying and praying this through this week of what a sort of an exodus in my life would look like. And the closest thing I could kind of get to was a move. How many people have ever moved before? Or you're living in the same house you were born in. It's like maybe some of you, like my children. Moving is a lot of work, especially if you have a family, right? You've got to pack your belongings. You've got to load your boxes up. You've got to get a U-Haul truck. You've got to move all your furniture, heavy furniture, into the U-Haul truck. You've got to get your family in there. You've got to travel. You've got to drive to your next house or destination. And then you got to unload. You got to set up. You got to put your new furniture up. You got to organize everything again, right? It's a move, and it's difficult. You can learn a lot about each other in the stress of a move. You can learn a lot about what's important to you, what stresses you out. When you're moving and packing your belongings up, you can find out a lot about your husband or your wife or your own children. Well, on a much larger scale, we have the book of Exodus, which is sort of like the move out of God's people out of captivity into a promised land. It's sort of like a huge moving. And you can imagine the sort of trial and stress that it must have taken to undergo sort of this exodus. And the story of Exodus reveals much about the people of Israel, just as a move might reveal about our own selves. But it also reveals more about God. Some of the most famous and mesmerizing stories come from this book. And it's no wonder that we get some of the clearest portraits of God's character from his actions and interactions with his people, with the Egyptians in the book of Exodus. During this time, we see God more clearly than we do in many of the other books of the Old Testament. God interacts in a very real, personal, and self-revelation sort of way. And so that's why it's important for us this morning. So we, as a brief overview, normally we'll spend some time in some specific verses, but we're going to do a quick overview of Exodus this morning before we eat together and celebrate. If you're familiar, kind of keep your eye on the text as we kind of scan through with me. As we said, Egypt is growing. It's the most powerful kingdom of the world, and there's this 70 member clan of the Hebrews that begin to grow. And you can read in verse 8 of Pharaoh of chapter 1, Pharaoh, there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us." And so he began to oppress them. He says in verse 10, "Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." After a while, you begin to forget about the service of others. Our nation is not only 300 years old. And we may remember some of the George Washingtons and the Ben Franklins and the Susan B. Anthonys. But how many more for every one of them have we forgotten? Well, it's not hard to imagine, after 400 years living in Egypt, that the story of Joseph kind of fades. Especially if you're the Pharaoh, who doesn't like to give credit too much to anybody else. And as a generation passes, the story of the work of Joseph and his people begin to fade. And even though his line continues to grow, in Pharaoh's mind, he fears them. Bigotry and fear and hate begins to stir in the heart of Pharaoh, and he says, "Let us oppress." The appreciation of Joseph and the favor of his people become replaced with fear and xenophobia and contempt for a Pacific people. And so Pharaoh enslaved the Hebrew people with violence and hard labor and oppression. But it didn't work. His plan didn't work. His plan was to suppress their growth and to keep them from multiplying. But we see that it won't work. Look at verse 12 of chapter 1. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were dread, with the dread of the people of Israel. And this is kind of be the theme, that he can't control God's people. As much as he'll try to oppress them, to give them hard labor, he'll make their hard work even harder, and yet they'll continue to flourish and thrive. And I wonder if there's any here who find themselves in a circumstance where they feel oppressed, or they feel burdened, or they feel downtrodden. They feel as if they are working without blessing. Well, the promise here for you is that God can do something in your life greater than what you can do for yourself. Even under the heaviest of circumstances, God, if he has a plan to prosper you, will do it. We see in the story of the Israelites, even the most powerful force in all the world could not stop the flourishing of God's plan. God's plan, God's will, God's strength is greater than the strength of men. Even the gods of Egypt, who they worshipped, were nothing to the God of gods. So the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied. And this is God's working. We fast forward a little bit into chapter 2. We read about the birth of Moses. Of course, Moses, you would say, is one of the central figures of the book of Exodus. Moses will be the one who leads God's people out of Egypt and eventually to the edge of the promised land. I would actually venture to say that though he is a main character, he's not the most central character. The point here of Exodus is that God is a central figure. And we've already been clued into that by the work of God through the oppression and the slavery of his people. And God chooses and raises up a young man named Moses. And if you know the story of Moses, Pharaoh, in his attempt to suppress the people, said that every child must be thrown into the Nile River. And there are some midwives who refused to do that, and they allowed Moses to be born, and Moses was hidden with his parents for some months. But you can't hide a baby from the Egyptians for very long. They're kind of loud, especially when they start walking. They're kind of hard to control, and so they need to sort of trust God. And so they put this baby in a basket, and they put him in the Nile, trusting that God will provide and care for this child. And in a way, in a fashion that only God can, the river that was supposed to kill Moses, drown him, leads him to his safety, to none other than Pharaoh's daughter himself, who draws him out of the water. In fact, the word for Moses means drawn out. Moses was literally drawn up out of the water that should have been his death, where he received life. And to add to the sovereignty and the wisdom of God's plan, not only was he brought into the court of Pharaoh, but his own mother was able to nurse him. So God is orchestrating his plan, even in the beginning stages of his people's flourishing. So Moses goes and he learns and he gets all of the wisdom and education that Egypt can offer. Hebrews will tell us that all the treasures of the world were offered to Moses. He had a lack of nothing. Anything he wanted, he could have. But as he grew older, he was at the same time being trained as a Hebrew. See, his mother would have taught him the stories of Genesis, would have told him about the promise that God made with their father, Abraham, and that if you trust in this promise, that God will one day make it greater than Pharaoh, that we will be a mighty people. We will bless the world. This is the promise God made. So you can imagine this sort of tension in Moses' life. At one hand, having everything he could ever want, comfort, familiarity, and then on the other hand, identity with his people and trust in God. And we see in verse 11, then one day of chapter 2, when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and looked on their burdens, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. And he looked this way and that, seeing no one, he struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. And when he went out the next day, behold, two Hebrews were struggling together. And he said to the man of the wrong, "Why do you strike your companion?" And he answered, "Who made you a prince and judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" And Moses was afraid and thought, "Surely this thing is known." When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. So now we see this new transition in Moses' life as he begins to identify more with his own people. His own people yet do not accept him. See, Moses will go on to be a great leader, but he has not yet learned what God has taught him. And so Moses strikes down in the same sort of oppression and anger and injustice as Pharaoh and the Israelites, or the Egyptians were to the Israelites. And so he was no better ultimately than the oppressors. And so he fled and went to Midian. Now the thing about Midian is in the land of Canaan. Canaan is the promised land. This is the land that God promised to Abraham that his people will inherit and possess. And so God's leader of God's people goes to God's land, but God's people is not there with him. And we'll read that Moses flourishes, becomes a shepherd. He finds a wife. He has a family. Things are going well for him. He's there for 40 years. And yet God's people continue to suffer and their burden grows under the oppression. Look in verse 23 of chapter 2. During those many days, the king of Egypt died and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. This is the plight now of God's people under the oppression of Pharaoh. And meanwhile, Moses is relaxing by a well, enjoying his life. The story continues that God then comes to Moses as a burning bush, a bush that is on fire and yet isn't consumed by that fire. And of course, he speaks to Moses and says to let my people go. You need to go to Pharaoh and tell him to set them free. Moses, of course, bucks against that, but is eventually convinced because God's promised to go with him. He says, who should I say that will send me? And God says, tell them I am sent you. As an interesting sort of side note, we have a lot of names for God. Provider, creator, sustainer, all of these things. Man has many names for God. If you simply Google it, you'll find some 50-odd different names. The Bible alone, but the one name God gives himself, you read about in chapter 3. He says, I am. Of course, this name was so sacred to God's people that they refused to even write the full name out. They would remove the vowels, and so all we have left is the consonants of Yahweh, the very name of God. Even to this day, we're not even sure how it's pronounced because we've never seen the whole word. So God's name for himself reveals something about him. He says to Moses as he enters the burning bush to take off your sandals because you're standing on sacred ground. The very presence of God demands holiness. And the very name, the breath of God, demands holiness. And yet uttered on the mouth of men or trampled by the feet of men, Moses is told to lead his people out of Egypt. And so he does. He goes back to Pharaoh. He gives many signs and wonders. Plagues come upon Egypt one by one. 10 ultimately, the last beings, one of the worst, the death of the firstborn son and every family who isn't covered by the blood of the lamb. And so that was the last straw for Pharaoh. He wakes up. His son is dead. And he says, go, leave. I've had enough. And Pharaoh leads his people. And then in the middle of their exodus, Pharaoh changes his mind and tells, go and chase them down and kill them. And of course, God provides by parting the Red Sea so his people can cross. And then that Red Sea comes down on all those who tried to chase after them. And then the rest of the story of Exodus is they're wandering through the wilderness to Mount Sinai as he received God's revelation and law and word for his people to govern them as they'd form a new nation. As they're told about how to interact with this God who is now leading them through the wilderness to this promised land. There's many grumblings and there's many repentance. There's many coming back to God and turning away from God again. But here in the book of Exodus, we really see God revealing himself and his faithfulness again to man. What's the whole point of the book of Exodus then? It's for knowing God. It's knowing God. God, Exodus tells the story of the covenant God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob continue to reveal himself to his creation as he forms this new people to himself. And he does this. He continues to choose and draw people to himself and reveals three major areas about himself, about his character. First, his faithfulness. Second, his sovereignty. And third, his glory. He reveals his faithfulness, his sovereignty, and his glory. First, his faithfulness. He remembers his people. Look again in the end of chapter 2. As we talk about the cry and the rescue from slavery. During those days, many of the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. That's comforting to you, is it? That God knows the plight of his people. God's faithfulness, not just to keep his oath and his covenant with Abraham, deliver his people out from slavery and bondage, but God knew the inward cry and groaning. He hears and he understands and he knows. Not in a knowing sense of I see and I can tell, but a knowing in a sense of an identity. See, David will say in Psalm 23 that the Lord is my shepherd and that he goes with me into the valley of the shadow of death. And he will guide me through it as he sets up a table for me in the presence of my enemies. See, God not only sees and knows in an intellectual sort of sense our suffering, but he identifies with our suffering because of the people and the identity of the people of God. He sees Israel under oppression and he knows. He knows in a way that we understand Abraham or Adam knew Eve. It's this intimate sort of nearness sense that God is as close to his people as God is ever going to get. He understands the plight and the oppression. He saw the people of Israel and God knew. This reminds me of the story in the Gospels where Jesus looks out on Jerusalem and it says that he had compassion. And the Greek word for compassion is really like a gut-wrenching sort of, I yearn for this people. And he says, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how I long to gather you under my wing like a hen gathers her young. You see, the compassion for Jesus is the same sort of knowing and remembering and caring for his people as God cares for his people. This intimate knowing and knowledge of God and his people is what marks the book of Exodus as they continue to travel to the journey. This is important for us because we also go through many struggles. Maybe we're not under slavery and oppression, but we face many hardship in our life. And Jesus tells us that persecution and suffering is inevitable. And yet God promises us to know us and to remember his covenant with us. So God is faithful. He remembers his people. He keeps his covenant and he keeps his word. The covenant keeping promise of Genesis chapter 12, as he makes to Abraham that your people will be a sojourner in a land that is not theirs for 400 years, came true. We see this in the first couple chapters of Exodus. And then he says, I will bring them out of that place. And so he raises up a man named Moses to do that. And what we learn from this is that Christ is this greater Moses. Christ is the true Israel and the ultimate deliverer. As we work through the book of Exodus, we'll see over and over again how Christ is the fulfillment of all the promises that God makes to his people. As he raises up Moses, Moses himself will say in chapter 8 that there will be one who is greater than I who will come, a greater deliverer. But Jesus is that one who will come deliver us not just from slavery of an oppression of a national sort, but from the slavery and oppression of sin, our bondage to sin that we're held captive to. Jesus comes and frees us. Jesus will be the true Israel, one who does not grumble and turn back and wish to go to Egypt, but one who faithfully follows and trusts in God's promises. Jesus' obedience will stand in contrast to the disobedience of God's people as they wander through the wilderness. Jesus ultimately will be the Passover lamb. If you skip into chapter 12, after the plagues, we see one of the worst. And the promise to save all those who put the blood of the lamb on their doorway. So the last plague, in order to convince Pharaoh to let his people go, God will send the angel of death to come and kill every firstborn, unless you have the blood of the lamb. So he tells Moses to tell his people to provide this meal and to take this lamb, take the blood of that lamb and put it over the doorway. And if that blood is on the doorway, when the angel of death comes, he'll pass over you. And this is what the people do. And this Passover is the thing that's is memorialized every year, the Passover feast in Jewish culture. We see this in the Gospel of John, where many times the Passover would come together and they would come to the tabernacle, they would come to the temple and celebrate the Passover together. And John will say of Jesus, this is the Lamb who would take on the sins of the world. See, John the Baptist, as well as John the Apostle, recognizes that Jesus is that true Lamb. If we intend to escape death and receive the mercy of God, we must look to the one whose blood atones for our sins. So God's faithfulness is revealed through all of Exodus. As you continue through the story of the wandering and the journey of them through the wilderness, God is over and over again receiving and keeping their complaints and delivering upon them. Manna from heaven, water from the earth. Even when they wanted to turn back and go to Egypt again because their journey was so rough, God would provide refreshing drink and manna for them. God over and over again promises to go with them. because he's faithful to his promise. For God to have given up would him to go back on his word. In fact, he even tests Moses and says that that's what he's going to do. When Moses is on the top of the mountain, Mount Sinai, receiving God's law, the Ten Commandments from God himself, his people and Aaron, Moses' brother, are down there at the bottom. And they begin to get a little impatient and bored, and they say, I want to worship something. And so Aaron, make us something. And Aaron, of course, makes a golden calf out of all the gold that they took with them from Egypt, and they begin to worship. And they want to kind of wax eloquent and say, well, we're remembering what God did for us by bringing us out. But in reality, they're worshiping an idol. And God says, Moses, your people are down there, and I'm about had it with them, and I'm just going to start over and make a great person out of you. And Moses' response is one that marks his faith and one that we read about in Hebrews chapter 11. Moses says, God, if you did that, what will the nation say about your faithfulness? You made a promise to these people to make a nation out of Abraham, not out of me. So if you were to go back, what will happen to your name? So God relents from his anger and decides not to wipe out Israelites and to combine his love with them. His anger goes down and he continues. He says, go back down, deal with this, and Moses will come and receive the law again a second time. See, God's faithfulness to his people is the character of the covenant that he made with Abraham, and he continues throughout the book of Exodus. But not only his faithfulness, but we see God's sovereignty, his power, his ability to do all that he wants to do, his ability. He is powerfully able to bring about his purposes in the lives of his people. See, this would not have been possible if God was not sovereign, if he had not the ability to make Moses perform those mighty works. In fact, everything that Moses does is a sign that is not from Moses, but from God himself. See, Moses had to do specific things. Throw the staff down, hold your arms up, put your staff in the water. All of this was to show that God was behind the working and the delivering of God's people. You needed to understand that God's sovereign ability to deliver upon his promises is the thing that keeps the people going. If you have a promise, but the inability to deliver upon that promise, it's not much hope in believing it. If I promised you $1 million right now, would you wait? Would you quit your job? Would you go take a mortgage out on a brand new house? Probably not, because I don't have it. I don't have the ability to give it to you. But God, who makes a promise, has the ability to deliver upon that promise, not just because he orchestrates all things, but because his strength is powerful enough to bring about all the things of the world necessary. He created it, and therefore he can make it and shape it. And we see this evidence in the 10 plagues, the bloody river, the swarm of locusts, the darkness, and of course the angel of death. Not only that, but as the Israelites are fleeing from Egypt, the Red Sea, the heaven, the manna from heaven, the rock of water, all of these things show the sovereign power of God. Every instance of the Exodus narrative is sovereignly orchestrated to the extent that the only plausible explanation for it is the sovereign hand of God, the mighty, powerful hand of God at work. And so you know God's faithfulness to deliver upon his promise, but his sovereign ability to do what he said he would do in the way he decides to do it. We must understand that not only is God faithful, but he's sovereign. He's powerful to orchestrate all things for the good of his people. We pick this up again in Romans chapter 8. And Paul probably referring to this, that your history of the people of God has always been God's leading and God's orchestrating and God working out all things by his sovereign hand. So Romans 8, in the middle of a deep theological conversation about God's sovereignty, he says that he works all things together for the good of those who are called according to the purpose. He says all things work together. And all things can only work together if there's someone who's able to work all things together. God is the sovereign worker. And he does this, he says, that they may know. Look at chapter 6, verse 7, as he talks with Moses and his people. Let's look in verse 6, chapter 6. Say therefore to the people of Israel, I am the Lord. I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will deliver you from slavery to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great acts of judgment. Why? I will take you to be my people, and I will be your God, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God, who has brought you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. And the point here God is doing is not simply to keep an oath and a promise, but to reveal himself, not just his faithfulness, but his sovereignty. All the mighty acts of judgment, the parting of the Red Sea, the guiding of a cloud and a fire in the wilderness, all of this is to show that God's sovereign hand is the orchestrator of the world. that they may know, I will be your God. You shall know that I am the Lord your God. Not just you, but the people around you. See, God's sovereign hand orchestrates the deliverance of God's people. He is powerfully able. So today, as we recognize in our own oppression and in our enchainment to sin, even if that bondage has been initially broken, we are still dealing with the effects of our sin. We look to God, who is powerfully able to do even more than we could hope or ask. God, who is able powerfully to do this, is the God that we serve. It's the God who delivered the people of God from the Egyptians. It's the same God who now dwells with his people. So we learn about God's faithfulness, God's sovereignty, and God lastly reveals his glory. The revelation of himself to a chosen race is a blessing to that people and a beacon of hope to the watching world. God's glory is the fundamental thing he hopes to reveal here in the book of Exodus. Really, that's the story of the whole Bible, if we're to be honest, that every book reveals the glory of God. But specifically here, he's got an aim to reveal his glory, to reveal himself. First, he reveals himself to a special people. This group of 70 that had grown into a multitude, who were feared and became the threat of Egypt, that eventually led, would become the nation through which all nations would be blessed, speaks to the glory of God for their whole history. The provision of their deliverance is owed to the faithful and sovereign mercy of God. So he reveals his glory to a special people by his works, but also by his presence. A bulk of the book of Exodus, there, the latter half, is dedicated to specific instructions about how to build the tabernacle. The tabernacle is where God will choose to dwell in the midst of his people as they're wandering. As a specific tent with specific rites and rituals, and Moses' brother Aaron will become the head of the priest who would help interact with that presence. And that would be the thing that guides them and would help atone for the sins. And the law that God gives to Moses to give to his people will be enacted in the relation to God's covenant. So in the presence of God, which will mark God's people, he gives them instructions to build the tabernacle. And this comes down to the presence of God. See, God's people is always marked by a presence, a nearness of God's presence. If there is no nearness, there is no people of God. And so his people, from the very beginning, God knew them and went with them and made a way for them, parted the Red Sea, provided for them in the wilderness, dwelled among them, guided them throughout the land, and eventually would protect them over and over again to keep his covenant, to show his sovereign hand, and to reveal his glory. His presence will be with them. But not just to a special people, but to the nations as well. See, the law was given to the Israelites, in part for the Israelites' sake, but also for the nations. See, God was making a nation for himself, and so he needed them to be distinct so that when the nations looked on the Hebrews, they would say, these people are not like us. Why? Because their God is a sovereign God. Their God is a holy God. They cannot be like us. They must be something different. So God's glory is revealed to the nations through the work that God does through the Hebrews, but also the law that he gives to them, the specific requirements. In a few weeks, we'll spend a whole sermon on just looking at the law of God and our relation to it. But we see God's glory revealed through the workings and the interactions of the Hebrews as they're led out of the Egyptian and into the wilderness. Well, the book of Exodus doesn't end with them getting to the promised land. In fact, they've still got many, many more years to go. One of the things we learn is that the Hebrews become so begrudged and wanting to go back that God ultimately punishes that generation and says that this generation will not enter into the promised land. And so they will wander for 40 years until a new generation is raised up and they will inherit the land. We read about that in the book of Joshua as that generation enters in and takes Canaan. But God's glory is revealed over and over again through his people, through his works, through his faithfulness, through his sovereignty and his presence dwelling with God's people. But what's the point for us this morning? Well, the covenant making and keeping God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the strong and victorious God that delivers the God's people out of Egypt, the God who led Moses and Israel out of and through the Red Sea, he is our God. He's the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And as Moses was drawn up out from the waters that were meant for his death, so we too are drawn up out of the rushing tide of condemnation. It's the same God who saves his people from oppression and slavery in the Old Testament, continues to do so under the New. We read this morning as our call to worship, Psalm 136. Flip there Let's continue to read the rest of it. Psalm 136. Talked about the steadfast love of God enduring forever, the covenant that he made within the Trinity to redeem a certain people, the covenant he made with Adam and with Noah and with Abraham, and the covenant he will make with Moses and his people continues to move forward until we receive the fulfillment of that covenant in Jesus. And we are drawn up out of our condemnation. Listen to starting in verse 1 of Psalm 136. It says, "Give thanks to the Lord for his good, for his steadfast love endures forever. Give thanks to the God of gods, for his steadfast love endures forever. Give thanks to the Lord of lords, for his steadfast love endures forever. To him who alone does great wonders, for his steadfast love endures forever. To him who by understanding made the heavens, for his steadfast love endures forever. To him who spread out the earth above the waters, for his steadfast love endures forever. To him who made the great lights, for his steadfast love endures forever. The sun to rule over the day." Verse 9, "the moon and the stars to rule over his night, the steadfast love endures forever. To him who struck down the firstborn of Egypt, for his steadfast love endures forever, and brought Israel out from among them, for his steadfast love endures forever. With a strong hand and an outstretched arm, for his love endures forever. To him who divided the Red Sea in two," verse 14, "and made Israel pass through the midst of it," verse 15, "but overthrew Pharaoh and his host in the Red Sea. To him who led his people through the wilderness, for his steadfast love endures forever." It continues like this, all the way into the promised land. But look in the verse 23. "It is he who remembered us in our low estate, for his steadfast love endures forever. And rescued us from our foes, for his steadfast love endures forever. He who gives food to all flesh, for his steadfast love endures forever. Give thanks to the God of heaven, for his steadfast love endures forever." Listen. This God who does all of these mighty works for the people in Egypt, deliver them, to bring them into the promised land, this covenant-keeping, faithful, mighty, sovereign God is the God who delivers his people from a bondage and captivity of sin. It is he, verse 23 says, who remembers us in our low estate and rescues us from our foes. What greater foe do we have than death and sin? And Jesus has told us that there is no death. There is no sting in death. There is no victory. Why? Because he has taken on the price of our sin. He has died for us so that we who will one day reign with him in heaven will no longer taste death. So we are drawn up out of the rushing tide of our condemnation. It is he who remembered us in our low estate. Jesus is the fulfillment of the promise that God made to Abraham and is the one to whom these Israelites will look as they go to God and follow God in the wilderness. As God continues to provide for them, their hearts should be longing for the one day where not only they inherit the land of Canaan, but they dwell with God forever. That promise is fulfilled in the person of Jesus who is remembered. So God promises to visit us in our lowest state, to rescue us, to know us intimately, to know us as he knew his people in Egypt, and to deliver us, and that comes through the blood of Jesus. So this morning as we conclude, would you turn your heart's affections to Jesus, who remembers you in your own oppression? While you are yet sinners, Romans says, Christ died for you. See, Jesus cares for us and knows us as he has compassion on his people to bring his people to himself. He visits us in our low estate and delivers us from the sting of death. He gives us a new body and a new heart. And the covenant that God made with Abraham is fulfilled in him as we experience God's love forever. As we continue over the next few weeks to explore the book of Exodus, we'll see God's faithfulness and sovereignty and his glory more pointedly as we visit certain stories. But for now, we celebrate now the suffering of Jesus to provide for us a way into the people of God. So not only do we get to just read about it, but we get to experience it ourselves. That's what we're going to celebrate now as we take the Lord's Supper. Would you pray with me? Father, you are mighty and you've done many things. And we can take no credit for the blessings of our lives. And just as you have delivered your people from the land of Egypt and have done many great works to show yourself, you do those same things to us. And you've done a greater work. You have raised up a greater Moses. You have performed a greater miracle. You have provided a perfect and spotless sacrificial lamb, the blood of which covers us. And so we now look and hold to the efficacy of that blood to save us, that death would pass over us and we could trust and believe in the covenant promises of God. So we ask, Lord, that as we now reflect, consider the work of Christ on the cross to secure that hope for us, would our hearts be stirred to be thankful for it and to worship you and to behold your glory in our lives and example them to the lives of others. Lord, we acknowledge our sin to you, and we will not hide our iniquity. But God, you have given Jesus as a propitiation for our sins so that we can stand not condemned, but justified. So we're thankful, God, for that. As we take and celebrate the Lord's Supper this morning, would you remind us of the death of Jesus, the body and the blood, and what it has accomplished for us. That as you provided manna for your people in the wilderness, you provide the bread of life for us today. And that you give food to all flesh that we celebrate now at the Lord's Supper. I trust you, Lord, to work the truth of these words into our hearts by your Spirit. We pray in the name of Jesus.